Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Welcome to the Tattered Cover at Colfax, everyone. We're delighted that you could join us tonight, not only to celebrate the release of the third installment in Deborah Harkness's New York Times best-selling All Souls trilogy, The Book of Life, but we wanted to take a moment to thank you on behalf of the Tattered Cover. It's because you shop locally, your continued dedication to visiting our store and attending our events that make evenings like this possible. So thank you. Give yourselves a round of applause. Now, here's the thing. I'm a big fan of our author tonight, all right? It isn't every day that we're treated to an author who can beautifully blend fact and fantasy, who can endear us to a set of characters who are so like us and yet so different, and who can make us stay up way, way, way too late. All right. So, The Book of Life concludes wonderfully, I think, Matthew and Diana's story in a thrilling voyage through time that asks us real questions about humanity. And our author tonight will continue that discussion because I'm sure you're tired of listening to me. So, without further ado, please welcome Miss Deborah Harkness.
Hello, everybody. Is this thing on? We're here. We made it. This is so exciting. I have never done a book event in Denver, in this part of the world, and I'm so thrilled to be here at the Tattered Cover. This is such an amazing store. I had a little walk around when I first got in here, and those of you who live in the Denver area are very lucky because this is a pretty amazing place. So, And I want to thank Erica and everybody else here at the store for having us here and for making us all feel so welcome. I also want to add my thanks to hers to all of you for supporting your local bookstore because, you know, this is really where the magic happens. You can see it on the faces of the kids who are looking for books and on the people who are upstairs in those comfy chairs, you know, going through some new volume. And, you know, these are treasures that will disappear like Ashmole 782 if we don't take care of them. So thank you for taking care of your local bookstore. So we're going to start with a quiz. How many of you have finished The Book of Life? How many of you have read the book twice? How many of you have read the book more than twice? Fair. Okay. Audible counts. Audible counts. Okay, well, you're officially the audience with the most hands raised since I've begun, but there are still people who didn't raise their hands. So I'm going to tell you now, and I'm also going to tell you again before the Q&A. We're not going to do, just because this is the Book of Life tour, we're not going to do any spoilers in the Q&A. So that means no mentioning characters who may or may not show up in the Book of Life, no talk of any plot corkscrews, no crystal ball gazing about characters' futures. I'm using my teacher voice now. However, obviously, you know, you are going to see me right here. And if you come up to the table and you use your inside voice, I will answer your question. But we're just not going to, you know, bleat it out and ruin anybody else's discovery of witches. So, as everybody probably in this room knows, the All Souls trilogy is the story of three main characters: Diana Bishop, a reluctant witch and historian of science at Yale University. Matthew Claremont, a geneticist at All Souls College in Oxford. That was it. That was a yip of happy. And he just, of course, happens to be 1,500 years old. And the third main character is not Galloglass. It's not Philippe. It's not even Isabeau. It is Ashmole 782. This very mysterious missing manuscript at Oxford's Bodleian Library that Diana called up sort of by accident, and which everybody wants, even though nobody really even understands what's in it. But of course, that's never stopped creatures from wanting something, not understanding it. We do that all the time. So we've been following the changing relationship between these three main characters. And somebody said to me, really, you think of the Book of Life as a character? Yes, I really do. And the whole point of this trilogy has been to chart their relationship. Not only to chart it in terms of like, okay, well, this happens and that happens, but to chart the ways in which the three main characters' relationship to each other changes, how that shifts over the course of the narrative. And when we started our story, we were very much looking at everything through a very narrow focus. And that narrow focus was provided by Diana Bishop, our reluctant witch. If you think way back, you know, lo, these 1,200 pages or so, to the beginning of A Discovery of Witches, you were seeing the world through Diana's eyes. You knew what she knew. And it was only around chapter 7 or 8 that we expanded our horizons a bit to look at the world through Matthew's eyes. And we then would sort of flip back at sort of 7 or 8 chapter intervals. And what we learned from that was that Diana wasn't really all that aware of what was going on around her a lot of the time. This is a common condition among academics. This is, you know, it's not unique to Diana. Diana, but we really got a sense through those shifts that you know, there was a kind of a bigger world out there that Diana was very slowly kind of becoming aware of. That expansion of our horizons increased dramatically in Shadow of Night. For one thing, Matthew and Diana went outside. If you think about A Discovery of Witches, almost everything happens inside somewhere. And when they go outside, things don't go well. You know, there's that kind of not very fun row along the river. There's the kind of not very fun walk in the garden that Diana takes. And so in Shadow of Night, suddenly this couple is in the midst of a very big Elizabethan household. They're in the midst of Matthew's circle of high maintenance friends. They're in major European cities like London and Prague, and they're not inside. They're out in the streets having to kind of figure out how they're going to be in the world. And that, too, represents a really important stage for them as a couple that does have a relationship that is forbidden in some people's eyes. That kind of coming out of the closet, literally, and being out in the world was really crucial to them. It kind of taught them things, survival skills that they really need. It also is true that in Shadow of Night, we actually saw Diana make friends. Because if you think again about Discovery of Witches, she had sort of nodding acquaintances, one of which she didn't like. And then a friend who she, you know, spoke on the phone to once. This is not a huge circle of intimate companions that Diana has around her. But of course, our circle, our sort of horizon, our viewpoint was even wider, because all the while that we were watching Diana and Matthew proceed in this greater world, we were also flipping back and forth between 1590, where Diana and Matthew were time walking, and the present, and checking back in with the people that Diana and Matthew left behind. Now, we didn't really focus all that much on their journey. It was more kind of like keeping in touch, but just for a moment, really try to put yourself in the shoes of those people who have been at Set Tour since November. You know, Matthew and Diana appear at the beginning of July. Every day for that time, they woke up thinking, maybe this will be the day they come home. And every day they went to bed thinking, okay, it wasn't today. But that doesn't mean anything bad happened. And then they get up and they do it again. And they've all been doing that since those two left. And, you know, it's not like they could Skype to check in to see how they were doing, which is why those anomalies that Isabeau started tracking were so important to the whole community. And as it was, they still waited, you know, the best part of 3 months to start when those started popping up. So it's been a really difficult time at SETTOR, a time of watching, a time of waiting. It's also been a time of loss because, of course, what you all know that Matthew and Diana do not know at the beginning of the Book of Life is that one of the women who raised Emily Mather, her beloved aunt, raised Diana, her beloved aunt Emily Mather, has in fact been tragically taken from them. And so to add to the just generic anxiety and kind of hesitation about being reunited with these two after clearly they've had quite an adventure, even if they don't know the details yet, is that they have to share some pretty bad news with them. And no one knows how they're going to react to that news. And the suspicion, of course, is not well. And so, you know, it was really difficult for me to begin the Book of Life. I felt at times like I was trying to launch a 747 with a slingshot, from a dead stop, because it was really kind of the cast of, and setting for a discovery of witches twisted with the part of the cast from Shadow and the character development from Shadow of Night. It was very difficult to figure out, given the weirdness of this reunion, who should own the viewpoint in the first chapter of the Book of Life. Diana? Well, this is how I imagined it would go if it was Diana. Diana would walk in. She'd say, "Where's M?" They'd tell her she's dead, at which point Diana would go into shock and grief, quite appropriate, which wouldn't help me get my 747 off the ground, right? Then we just sit on the runway for a little while. Then, or we could do it through Matthew, who, let's face it, would just be in a tearing rage for most of it. Also not helpful. I wrote the first five chapters through more points of view than you would ever care to know, including, in my desperation, Cora the Fire Drake. And I'm not kidding you. Because I finally thought, oh, forget it. You know, this is, nothing's going to work. But what I learned from that was it really drove home this point that every single person in that chateau had a different memory of what had happened to Emily. They had a different take on the events of that day. They had a different story they wanted to tell. They had a different set of anxieties based on the secrets they knew that nobody else knew. And so in the first chapter of the Book of Life, our perspective is very broad. It's kaleidoscopic. We see everyone in the chateau and check in with all of them. We even check in with two of SETTOR's ghosts, who, unbeknownst to Diana and Matthew, are watching them as they come up the drive to SETTOR. And I told you, you couldn't do any spoilers, but now, of course, I'm going to do one because it's not much of a book reading if I don't actually read from the book. So I'm going to dip into the first 35 pages or so. So you're just going to all have to accept my apologies. If you're purists, this is a good moment to put your finger in your ear and like hum a little song. Ghosts didn't have much substance. All they were composed of was memories and heart. Atop one of SETTOR's round towers, Emily Mather pressed a diaphanous hand against the spot in the center of her chest that even now was heavy with dread. "Does it ever get easier?" Her voice, like the rest of her, was almost imperceptible. The watching, the waiting, the knowing. "Not that I've noticed," Philippe de Clermont replied shortly. He was perched nearby, studying his own transparent fingers. Of all the things Philippe disliked about being dead, the inability to touch his wife Isabeau, his lack of smell or taste, the fact that he had no muscles for a good sparring match, invisibility topped the list. It was a constant reminder of how inconsequential he had become. Emily's face fell, and Philippe silently cursed himself. Since she died, the witch had been his constant companion, cutting his loneliness in two. What was he thinking, barking at her as if she were a servant? "Perhaps it will be easier when they don't need us anymore," Philippe said in a gentler tone. He might be the more experienced ghost, but it was Emily who understood the metaphysics of their situation. What the witch had told him went against everything Philippe believed about the afterworld. He thought the living saw the dead because they needed something from them. Assistance, forgiveness, retribution. Emily insisted these were nothing more than human myths, and it was only when the living moved on and let go that the dead could appear to them. This information made Isabeau's failure to notice him somewhat easier to bear, but not much. "I can't wait to see Em's reaction. She's going to be so surprised." Diana's warm alto floated up to the battlements. "Diana and Matthew," Emily and Philippe said in unison, peering down to the cobbled courtyard that surrounded the chateau. "There," Philippe said, pointing at the drive. Even dead, he had vampire sight that was sharper than any human's. He was also still handsomer than any man had a right to be, with his broad shoulders and devilish grin. He turned the ladder on Emily, who couldn't help grinning back. "They're a fine couple, are they not? Look at how much my son has changed." Vampires weren't supposed to be altered by the passing of time, and therefore Emily expected to see the same black hair, so dark it glinted blue, the same mutable gray-green eyes, cool and remote as a winter sea, the same pale skin and wide mouth. There were a few subtle differences, though, as Philippe suggested. Matthew's hair was shorter, and he had a beard that made him look even more dangerous, like a pirate. She gasped. "Is Matthew bigger?" "He is. I fattened him up when he and Diana were here in 1590. Books were making him soft. Matthew needed to fight more and read less." Philippe had always contended there was such a thing as too much education. Matthew was living proof of it. "Diana looks different, too. More like her mother with that long, coppery hair," Em said, acknowledging the most obvious change in her niece. Diana stumbled on a cobblestone, and Matthew's hand shot out to steady her. Once, Emily had seen Matthew's incessant hovering as a sign of vampire overprotectiveness. Now, with the perspicacity of a ghost, she realized that this tendency stemmed from his preternatural awareness of every change in Diana's expression, every shift of mood, every sign of fatigue or hunger. Today, however, Matthew's concern seemed even more focused and acute. "It's not just Diana's hair that's changed." Philippe's face had a look of wonder. "Diana is with child. Matthew's child." Emily examined her niece more carefully. Philippe was right, in part. "You mean with children," she said. "Diana is having twins." "Twins," Philippe said in an odd voice. He looked away, distracted by the appearance of his wife. "Look, here are Isabeau and Sarah with Sophie and Margaret." "What will happen now, Philippe?" Emily asked, her heart growing heavier with anticipation. "Endings, beginnings," Philippe said with deliberate vagueness. "Change." "Diana has never liked change," Emily said. "That is because Diana is afraid of what she must become," Philippe replied. So, once the news is broken to Diana and Matthew about Emily's death, and explanations are sort of hastily put forward, although the real concern obviously is on Diana, Matthew, not surprisingly, swings into overprotective mode, as Diana, not surprisingly, tries to work through her immediate grief at the news of this death and to process it. And so Matthew whisks Diana off to his tower rooms. And so the second chapter of the book, it was quite easy to figure out whose perspective we would have. It would be Matthew, because Matthew being a vampire doesn't need to sleep much. And on those long hours between midnight and dawn, he, when Diana is in restless sleep, he can sort of let go enough, provided there's someone with her, to watch over her, to at least move around the castle himself, to stretch his legs, to also check in and have private one-on-one reunions with some of those people in the castle. And some of those reunions are more interesting and difficult than others. He has a kind of a difficult reunion with Hamish, who's really kind of annoyed with him. And he also has a reunion with his nephew, Galloglass. Now, this again is interesting because by Matthew's reckoning, he saw Galloglass about 10 days ago in 1591. By Galloglass's reckoning, it's been more than 400 years, and Galloglass has been keeping an awful lot to himself during that intervening 400 years. And so you would imagine when Matthew and Galloglass got together, there'd be a deep, you know, intense heart-to-heart. But these are de Clermonts and vampires, and so, of course, nobody says anything about any of that. Instead, the two of them circle around each other, sort of trying to gauge who's going to be the one to give first. And of course, there's some other little problems with Diana and Matthew's reentry. And one of those little problems is named Cora. So I'm going to read a bit from chapter two, where we're back in Matthew's perspective. Matthew raced down the curving stone staircase that wound between his tower rooms at Set Tour and the main floor of the chateau. He avoided the slippery spot on the 30th tread and the rough patch on the 17th, where Baldwin's sword had bashed the edge during one of their arguments. Matthew had built the tower addition as his private refuge, a place apart from the relentless busyness that always surrounded Philippe and Isabeau. Vampire families were large and noisy, with two or more bloodlines coming uncomfortably together and trying to live as one happy pack. This seldom happened with predators, even those who walked on two legs and lived in fine houses. As a result, Matthew's tower was designed primarily for defense. It had no doors to muffle a vampire's stealthy approach and no way out except for the way you came in. His careful arrangements spoke volumes about his relationships with his brothers and sisters. Galloglass was crooning a sea shanty in the chateau's great hall. For reasons Matthew couldn't fathom, every other verse was punctuated by expletives and ultimatums. After a moment of indecision, Matthew's curiosity won out. "Bloody fire drake," Galloglass said. He had one of the pikes down from the cache of weapons by the entrance and was waving it slowly in the air. "Farewell and adieu to you, ladies of Spain. Get your arse down here, or Granny will poach you in white wine and feed you to the dogs. For we've received orders for to sail for Old England. What are you thinking, flying around the house like a demented parakeet? And we may never see you fair ladies again." "What the hell are you doing?" Matthew demanded. Galloglass turned wide blue eyes on Matthew. "Trying to catch your wife's wee beastie." Galloglass made a sudden upward thrust with his pike. There was a shriek of surprise, followed by a hail of pale green scales that shattered like isinglass when they hit the floor. The blonde hair on Galloglass's forearm shimmered with their iridescent green dust. He sneezed. Cora, Diana's fire drake familiar, was clinging to the minstrel's gallery with her talons, chattering madly and clacking her tongue. She waved hello to Matthew with her barbed tail, piercing a priceless tapestry depicting a unicorn in a garden. Matthew winced. "I had her cornered in the chapel, up by the altar, but Cora is a cunning lass," Galloglass said with a touch of pride. "She was hiding atop Grandad's tomb, her wings spread wide. I mistook her for an effigy. Now look at her, up in the rafters, vainglorious as the devil, and twice as much trouble. Why, she's put her tail through one of Isabeau's favorite draperies. Granny is going to have a stroke." "If Cora is anything like her mistress, cornering her won't end well," Matthew said mildly. "Try reasoning with her instead." "Oh, aye, that works very well with Auntie Diana." Galloglass sniffed. whatever possessed you to let Cora out of your sight? The more active the fire drake is, the calmer Diana seems, Matthew explained. Perhaps, but Cora is hell on the decor. She broke one of Granny's several vases this afternoon. Oh, so long as it wasn't one of the blue ones with the lion heads that Philippe gave her, I shouldn't worry. Matthew groaned when he saw Galloglass's expression. Merde. That was Hélène's response, too, Galloglass said, leaning on his pike. Isabel will have to make do with one less piece of pottery, Matthew said. Cora may be a nuisance, but Diana is sleeping soundly for the first time since we came home. Oh, well, that's all right, then. Just tell Isabel that Cora's clumsiness is good for the grandbabies. Granny will hand over her vases as sacrificial offerings. Meanwhile, I'll try to keep the flying termagant entertained so Auntie can sleep. How are you going to do that? Matthew said with skepticism. Sing to her, of course. Galloglass looked up. Cora cooed at his renewed attention, stretching her wings a bit farther so that they caught the light from the torches stuck into brackets along the walls. Taking this as an encouraging sign, Galloglass drew a deep breath and began another booming ballad. My head turns round, I'm in a flame, I love like any dragon. Say, would you know my mistress's name? Cora clacked her teeth in approval. Galloglass grinned and began to move the pike like a metronome. He waggled his eyebrows at Matthew before singing his next lines. I sent her trinkets without end, gems, pearls, to make her civil, till, having nothing more to send, I sent her to the devil. Good luck, Matthew murmured, sincerely hoping that Cora didn't understand the lyrics. So, of course, Cora is really the first sign that the people in the chateau have that maybe Diana isn't the same witch she was when she left. Because Diana and Matthew are trying to keep sort of the news of her changes and the news that she's a weaver and her heightened magic kind of under wraps until they sort out exactly what happened back in May. But it's pretty hard to keep Cora contained. And they've tried to sell Cora off, you know, write Cora off as a souvenir, but no one's really buying that. And of course, Diana is a very different witch. And when her grief recedes a bit, as everyone's grief does, and she begins to kind of emerge from those tower rooms, the witch who emerges is really a far cry from the one who stepped into the past in October. So you might wonder, well, what is it that makes Diana come down those curving stairs and meet up with the world again? And the answer to that question is Matthew's older brother, Baldwin. And this will be my last little excerpt for the night. And with Chapter 3, when Diana comes out of the tower rooms, we're back in Diana's point of view. But it's a very different, again, wider understanding of the world than that what we're used to. The de Clermont family library was bathed in a gentle pre-dawn light that made everything in it appear in soft focus. The edges of the books, the strong lines of the wooden bookcases that lined the room, the warm golden and blue hues of the Aubusson rug. What it could not blunt was my anger. For 3 days, I had thought that nothing could displace my grief over Emily's death. But 3 minutes in Baldwin's company had proved me wrong. Come in, Diana. Baldwin sat in a throne-like Savonarola chair by the tall windows. His burnished red-gold hair gleamed in the lamplight, its color reminding me of the feathers on Augusta, the eagle that Emperor Rudolf had hunted with in Prague. I looked around the room. We weren't the only ones to have been summoned to Baldwin's impromptu meeting. Waiting by the fireplace was a waif of a young woman with skin the color of skim milk and black, spiky hair. Her eyes were deep gray and enormous, fringed with thick lashes. She sniffed the air as if scenting a storm. Verin, Matthew said. He had warned me about Philippe's daughters, who were so terrifying that the family asked him to stop making them. But she didn't look very frightening. Farron's face was smooth and serene, her posture easy, and her eyes sparkled with energy and intelligence. Were it not for her unrelieved black clothing, you might mistake her for an elf. Then I noticed a knife hilt peeking out from her high-heeled black boots. "Wolfling," Farron said to Matthew. It was a cold greeting for a sister to give her brother, but the look she gave me was even more frigid. "Witch?" "It's Diana," I said, my anger flaring. "I told you there was no way to mistake it," Farron said, turning to Baldwin without acknowledging my reply. "Why are you here, Baldwin?" Matthew asked. "I wasn't aware I needed an invitation to come to my father's house," he replied. "But as it happens, I came from Venice to see Marcus." The eyes of the two men locked. "Imagine my surprise at finding you here," Baldwin continued. "Nor did I expect to discover that your mate is now my sister. Philippe died in 1945. So how is it that I can feel my father's blood vow, smell it, hear it?" "Someone else will catch you up on the news," Matthew said, taking me by the hand and turning to go back upstairs. "Neither of you is leaving my sight until I find out how that witch tricked a blood vow from a dead vampire." Baldwin's voice was low with menace. "It was no trick," I said, indignant. "Was it necromancy, then? Some foul resurrection spell?" Baldwin asked. "Or did you conjure his spirit and force him to give you his vow?" "What happened between Philippe and me had nothing to do with my magic and everything to do with his generosity." My own anger burned hotter. "You make it sound as though you knew him," Baldwin said. "That's impossible." "Not for a time walker," I replied. So that's page 36, and as usual, by about page 36, Matthew's carefully laid plans for a smooth reentry into his family, accompanied by a very orderly military campaign against the congregation with, you know, a low body count and very, you know, easy progress, has pretty much been blown to smithereens, given what happens in the first 36 pages. And, you know, I'm at that point now with the trilogy done where a lot of interviewers ask me the following question. Tell me what the All Souls trilogy is about in one sentence. If anyone has any ideas how I answer that, I would like to hear them in the signing line portion of our evening. But it's really hard to say what the All Souls trilogy is about, because of course it's about lots of things. First and foremost, it's about the kind of power that can only come if you look yourself in the eye in the mirror every day and you accept who you are and you celebrate it. Because if you don't do that, it doesn't matter how many spell books you have, you're never going to have any power in the world. It's also been about the power and importance of empathy in a world that would much rather draw distinctions between people than to emphasize what we have in common. And I mean empathy, not tolerance. Because as Rabbi Lowe told us in Shadow of Night, tolerance is one of those fragile things that can be taken away. And what tolerance says is, yeah, okay, I'll put up with you. What empathy says is, I understand you and I value you. And the whole books, the whole series, all of them have been about what a difference empathy and understanding can make. And of course, it's also been from the very beginning about family. Now, I'm not talking about a traditional family of a man and a woman and two children and a dog. Because that's actually not a traditional family, historically speaking. What families have always been is a huge conglomeration of people that get scooped up together, that throw their lot in with each other and pledge a mutual responsibility and love and compassion and caring to each other. And back in the day, that meant it was you and your wife's children from a former marriage and your children from a former marriage and your servants and their relatives and you, the children of friends who died. That was your family. And you all tried to survive together. That was the only way to survive. And that's the kind of traditionally blended family that Matthew and Diana are having to put together in book three. Now, A Tale of Forbidden Love makes for much better advertising copy than the most bizarre blended family in the history of the world. But nevertheless, while you've been taking in the story of forbidden love, you've also been seeing just how important it is for Matthew and Diana to have not just each other, but a network of friends and family and loved ones who will help them face whatever challenges may come their way. And there are a lot of challenges in the Book of Life. The congregation, the covenant, finding Ashmole 782, finding the missing bits of Ashmole 782, putting it together, old enemies, new enemies, you name it. But because they have a family, their chances of getting through that are pretty darn good. So with that, I'm going to turn the floor over to you and your questions. I want to thank once again the Tattered Cover for having us here tonight. And thanks to all of you for being such a great audience. Thank you. Thank you. So just a reminder again, no discussion of characters who may or may not appear, no plot questions for Book of Life, and no crystal ball gazing about characters who appear in Book of Life. I will repeat your question, so don't worry if you're in the back and you didn't hear them, because I will make sure that you know what it is. All right, there's already hands up. This never happens in my classroom. I have to extract questions. The lady in the striped shirt. Okay, so the question is, this is one of those mad professor skills I have. I'm going to take this statement and turn it into a question. So the question is, might there be more stories about the Bishop de Clermont funky blended family? And the short answer is, I don't know. And the reason for that is because I'm really trying right now to kind of just take a little bit of a rest. The last 5 years have been wonderful, but they've been fairly intense for a middle-aged college professor, it must be said. And so if creativity is a well, my water level is really low. And I would just, all of us here have heard the concept of the rebound relationship. I don't want to write a rebound book. I really want to do whatever I do next. And I have lots of stories to tell you. Lots. It's not that I'm sitting around thinking I have no idea what to do next. Actually, I'm kind of in the enviable position of being spoiled for choice. And so I just kind of want to take a little bit of time and, you know, figure out what I want to do for the next book. But there will be more books of all kinds of descriptions and ways. And so, as Philippe would say, never is a very long time. So I would never want to say never about revisiting the Bishops and de Clermonts. So you're very welcome. Thank you. Ma'am, right here in the green.
I'm a really big fan of the Jewel House.
Extra credit.
And I'm wondering, as a historian who looks at alchemy, what you think of Jung's commentaries on alchemy?
Okay, so the question is, the lady referred to my second work of academic nonfiction, The Jewel House, and she wondered what, as a historian of science and alchemy, I thought about Carl Jung's theory, sort of exegesis and development of ideas in the alchemical corpus. And Jung is somebody who used alchemical imagery in psychoanalysis, essentially, to look at sort of big archetypes in the human consciousness. I think it's fascinating and wonderful. I also think, as a historian, it's not something that I can make ready access to in any of my analyses, because of course I need to be able to document and prove everything through recourse to texts. So as a historian of alchemy, one of the challenges is so much of what Jung argued seems quite persuasive, but I can't actually demonstrably prove that any of my research subjects had any of these ideas of their own. So it's what I did do, however, in the All Souls trilogy was Jung talks a lot about alchemy as a metaphor for transformation, for personal transformation. So it's really alchemy is not about the philosopher's stone, except insofar as that philosopher's stone is a metaphor for the transformation of the spirit to higher levels. Now, that is something that my research subjects believed would happen if you came up with a philosopher's stone. Yeah, you'd have something that could turn anything to gold, but it would also purify you. And so transformation is a huge motif that I play with throughout these stories, and really is the kind of, you know, the philosophical core of the All Souls trilogy is the power of transformation and how transformation needs a kind of fruitful tension of opposites in order to happen. So that's my approach at an answer. Great question. Yes, in the back, in the black shirt. So the question is about where I came up with Blood Rage. So one of the things that was really important to me was that my preternatural, i.e. demon and vampire, and supernatural creatures, i.e. witches, and I get into these kind of long, drawn-out fights with people about how my vampires aren't supernatural, and they say, yes, they are. I say, no, actually, they're really not, because what that means is above nature, and they're not. The witches are, but they're the only ones. So these the vampires, the demons, the witches, it was really, really important to me that there were plausible explanations to explain some of the human myths about these creatures. So one of certainly the myths of the vampire that humans like to tell themselves is about this insatiable need for blood. And I kept thinking, well, okay, imagine that came from somewhere. It wasn't really true, but there's a grain of truth in it. What would that grain look like? And that's where I came up with Blood Rage. And it also was something that helped to underscore the fact that really, it's not easy being a vampire. Which, when I first came up with the idea for this series, one of the reasons that I was perplexed and was struck by the problem of the popularity of these kinds of beings is that all of the book covers that I saw on an airport wall in Puerto Vallarta when I was on vacation made it seem as though being a witch was great news for a woman, which historically speaking has not been true. Okay? And yet these book covers, it was like, you know, yay, I'm a witch. And then the thing, and the vampires, it was as though, you know, everyone would be completely delighted to have a vampire boyfriend or son-in-law, and that they were getting a huge amount of romantic action as a result, which again, like in my experience of people bringing home people who are slightly different, is not actually likely. And so, you know, so it really was important for me that, you know, that we underscore the ways in which being a vampire or being involved with a vampire would be really quite difficult in all kinds of pragmatic ways. And the Blood Rage gave me sort of another way to kind of explain some of Matthew's more annoying personality traits. And that's what it's really about. And also, again, to take that sort of gloss of imperfection, of perfection that's on vampires and kind of go, wait a minute, let's think this through. Good question. Good question. Over here, any questions? Yes, ma'am. Yeah?
With the popularity of TV series based on books, would you be involved in the production and the decisions, or just leave it?
Okay, so the question is about sort of a screen adaptation, and if there was one, if I would be interested in being involved. So for those of you who don't know, the film rights to the trilogy were purchased in the spring of 2011 by Warner Brothers Picture, but they have since reverted back to me. I am now, once again, the legal guardians of the Bishop Claremonts. And it wasn't because Warner Brothers wasn't committed. It wasn't because they didn't throw a lot of energy and talent at the project. It was simply because at the end of 18 months, it was absolutely clear that it was that we were not in a place where we could move forward with shooting a two-hour movie based on a discovery of witches that we would be happy with. And so the rights reverted to me. I was finishing the Book of Life, and I said, hold all my calls, because I actually felt quite convinced that if I didn't get this into your hands sooner rather than later, you were all going to explode. And so I focused on the Book of Life. And so it's been about four weeks that I have been in conversation with other interested parties. And maybe in another 4 weeks, we'll have an announcement to make. I, of course, would love to be involved in whatever capacity we can agree mutually that I can be involved, which often means hardly at all, or it can mean more or less or whatever. The real truth is that I am not an experienced screenwriter. And while I think I could do it and would like to try it, it's certainly... you know, would also make, you know, other writing projects, you know, there'd be a long queue in terms of other writing projects. And so there are some, you know, difficult decisions both for the production team and for me to make about that. So I'll keep you posted on where we are with all of that. Yes, over by the bookcases.
If you decide to do this, what actor do you...
It follows as the night, the day. So the question is, which actor would I like? And I'm guessing you especially would like to know which one I would like to play Matthew. Okay, she's nodding, yes. And Gallo class, yes. You're also very fickle. I remember when it was Matthew all the time, and now Gallo class, ever since Shadow, he's had some competition. I will never say who I think should play any of these roles unless they're cast in them. And I will tell you why. Because I'm a professor, and that's what I do. The reason why is because I have this nightmare vision of that poor man's first press junket for the movie or the TV, where he sits down at a table with an interviewer for Entertainment Weekly or fill in the blank, and they say, so did you know at the tattered cover in Denver in 2014, Deborah Harkness said she wanted, not you, to play Matthew. And I don't want any part of that. So unless they actually cast someone I think would be great in the role, and I can say, I have always thought he would be a wonderful Matthew, you will never hear me say it. Duly noted, and not for the first time, duly noted. Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. And its presence both in Diana's life and in the sort of the demon and sort of our understanding of what mental illness is. And, you know, in the first book, you really focus on how Diana uses other sorts of energy to express anxieties. And throughout the rest of the series, it's sort of, I guess my question is it her acceptance of self and expression of magic that allows that anxiety to decrease? And is the empathy piece also about our differences in terms of how we think and see the world? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the question is about the way that mental illness and mental health sort of are woven through the story and what the significance of that. And is Diana's sort of decreasing level of anxiety and mastery of self sort of part of that kind of accepting of who she is and what that, you know, and her magic and her power. And mental health today of all days, on a day when we've had very sad news having to do with mental health, you know, it is absolutely clear to me that we still are nowhere near dealing with mental health issues in this country. And that, you know, what really worries me is the ways in which things are being either overtreated or undertreated, and just the way that people feel so isolated and unable to talk about it. You know, I have a lot of students who suffer from anxiety disorders. I have a lot of friends. I suffer from anxiety problems myself. These are things we shouldn't be ashamed of, that we should be able to talk about. And I think it is absolutely crucial that we do a better job being empathetic. You know, I'm always saying, you know, if you had a horrible, you know, pulmonary condition, you would not be apologizing or trying to like get on and get on with your life without treatment. So why would you not take your mental health as seriously? So, but I also do think that, you know, a lot of anxiety can come, frankly, from trying to be something you're not. It's, you know, if you're going to be anxious, that's an ideal situation to be anxious in. And so that's part of it too, is, you know, is being able to say, yes, I have this problem, or I have this need, or this is who I am, and being able to own that and not, and feel that when you say that, the world's not going to end. So that's real. It's just really, it's so important to me. And I just, again, I think as a culture, we just need to be better with this, really. Question here in the front row.
Mine is to do with the time travel.
Okay.
Now, when her father, or when they went back, and they're gone for however long amount of time, is that the amount of time that they're gone in the present? Like, if they go back for a week, they've been gone for a week when they return, or?
Not necessarily. So the question is about time travel. So here's the thing. I use scientific basis for time travel, because everything has to have a scientific basis, even Diana's magic. I use as my basis the multiverse theory of quantum mechanics, which basically says that there are multiple timelines, and that every time you make a decision, you essentially, there's a new universe in which you've made the opposite decision. So if you came here and you made a right turn into the parking lot, there is actually a universe in which you kept going, a universe in which you turned left. Now, you may still end up here in this room with me after, because then you make other things to accommodate it. But it basically just posits this sort of infinite number of universes. And so it's really about what time walking allows you to do is to hopefully, when you slip between these time streams, that you have some ability to steer. And so, you know, because getting from point A to B is quite, you know, would be difficult if there's an infinite number of possibilities. And Diana alludes to that. So as a time walker, and now as a weaver, she's got a better way of getting to where she's trying to go. It does not mean that all those timelines are consistent. No, it just so happens that she made that work for her in this story. That's the way it worked. You know, and it worked that way from the moment she left Madison. She left Madison, she arrived the next moment in 1590. She left 1590, she arrived the next moment, you know, as if she'd been there continuously in Madison. But that may be a product more of Diana than the way time works. We have time for just a few more questions before we go to the sign. The lady in the gray. Sure.
I
So the question is about, you know, who are these demons and where do they come from and why don't we know more about them? And partly it's because they are the unstable ones. And so they're kind of shunned by the other seemingly more stable, although you kind of wonder, you know, but that's part of the problem, right? Is that, you know, we say, oh, well, they're nuts, and then can kind of dismiss them. So demons were based on a classical foundation. the reason they're spelled funnily, as people say, you know, why are they spelled that way? Is because in the classical past, a demon spelled the way I spelled it were your guiding spirits. They were the voices in your head that told you to do things. And that was in the Greek tradition. In the Roman tradition, the demon became something called genius, the genius. And there was your genius led you around until it was like a guardian spirit. And then something very interesting happened in Christianity. When Christianity came along, we kept genius as a mark of distinction, but we kind of pushed the demons off to the side. The A dropped out. They became voices in your head that you shouldn't listen to because you really should just be talking to God. And they became evil and associated with Satan and pulling you away and the forces of darkness and got red glowy eyes. And so part of the problem too with demons and the kind of where they are in this story is that they're really so marginalized, so made into the other and evil and bad that they're just, you know, they're at the bottom of the creature food chain, essentially. And they are the creative misfits of the world. So, you know, they're kind of deliberately on the edges of the story, but it's a great question. Yeah. Final question, the lady in the blue and white polka dots.
Can you talk a little bit about your writing process for the trilogy? When you were writing the first book, did you know that it was going to be three books? And did you outline everything, your character development and all that?
So the question is about my writing process, and specifically how did I conceptualize the whole story from the beginning? Was I organized about it? So, and did things like outlining. I knew that this was a story in three parts. Part one was in the present, part two was in the past, and part three was in the present. And that was because, as a historian, I believe the past is meaningful and relevant to the present and the future. And I wanted to demonstrate that, and I did that by putting Matthew and Diana in the past so that they could learn things they simply couldn't learn in the present. I thought, in my complete inexperience, that I could tell this in one book that had three parts. And I believe that all the way up until about page 422 of the Manuscript of Discovery, where I was on about chapter 17, and thought, okie dokie, not one book. But the structure remained the same. And because it was one story, I did know where we were going the whole time. I knew the middle part, I knew the end part, I knew the beginning part. But I am not an outliner. And I say that as a professor who probably shouldn't say that, but I don't get it. I've never thought that way. I cannot outline. I become hopelessly paralyzed because I can't remember where the Roman numerals and the letters go. And then I just come to a complete stop. And so I don't do that. I do kind of huge maps that sort of look like the London Underground with lots of colored magic markers. And so it really was, to me, it was like a journey that we're on a map. I knew where we were leaving. I knew that we were going to hit like Chicago in the middle of it. And I knew we were going to end up in Boston. But I didn't know exactly what route we were going to take all the time. And that turned out to be a really good thing because, you know, unexpected things can happen that are wonderful. Like the door can blow open on the front of the old lodge and gallows glass can walk in. Because I can tell you right now, there was no gallows glass in my original plans at all. And now, like, I can't even imagine the story without gallows glass. Same thing for Hamish. No plans for Matthew to have a best friend at all. And so I like to think there was a great tension between a plan and enough flexibility to allow the story to have a kind of organic feeling. Because I don't know about you, but I can actually tell sometimes when a writer has stuck so rigidly to their outline, even when it's not working, that I kind of just wish they would have, you know, like flown their freak flag a little bit and gone for it. So that's kind of that's how I did it. Not probably the way, and I will also say I write chronologically. I can't bounce around. I started with chapter one of Witches, and I wrote all the way through to the last chapter of the Book of Life. So I may not be an outliner, but apparently I am a concrete sequential sort of person when it comes to writing. All right. Well, thanks again for your questions.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.